Welcome to Software Quality Talk. I'm Mickey O'Neill, your host. Today's topic is test team leadership, and we'll be talking with Randy Rice, author and principal consultant of Rice Consulting, about how to get the best results from your test team. Randy Rice is a leading author, speaker, and consultant in the field of software testing and software quality. Rice is a certified software quality analyst, certified software test engineer, and a fellow of the Life Office Management Association. He's worked with organizations worldwide to improve the quality of their information systems and optimize their testing processes. Randy, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's good to be here, Mickey.
Hey, it's good having you. We're talking today about a topic you're really so thoroughly versed in, and I know that our listeners are right there with you. They're very concerned about software testing, making sure that the quality of the applications is there, that it fulfills what it's supposed to do, that it does it flawlessly and reliably time after time. So to get from point A to point B, from the time that software is written to the time that it's actually ground level in use by the end user, there's a lot of testing. There's a lot of steps to go through to make sure that it's going to work. Is that right?
That's right. And one of the things that we talk about a lot in our courses is that, you know, this is not just one team's job. And traditionally, when you look at what people do in testing projects in companies, over the years, the tradition has been you build it and then you test it. And one of the, I guess if there is something like a recent development in testing in the past 10 years or so, it's just the awareness that this is a whole life cycle process, and that quality is not something you test in. Security is not something you patch in. It's something that you design in and you build in. And it's interesting because it's the same idea that revolutionized the U.S. automobile industry. The Japanese started doing in-process inspections to get better cars, and here in the U.S. it took getting some pretty stiff competition for us to see that in our own manufacturing plants, Ford, GM, and such. After they saw the value of an in-process inspection, then they went to that, and we in software have yet to catch up. But we still have these things called test teams, and we still have people that lead them, and we still have this one group that people look to be kind of like the guardians of the software quality.
And they should. But the key word here is team, because mm-hmm. when you've got a team, you're talking many people, many personalities. There's got to be a leader. It's got to be a well-defined position. Mm-hmm. And that person had better be leading the team all in a direction that they all understand. And there are different types of teams. So what makes leading a test team different than other types of technical teams?
Well, for one thing, you have this one group of people that everyone is looking to be like the guardian of quality and to find all the problems in the software.
Of course, you're the test team after all.
That's right. That's what they're paying us to do, you know, to find the problems. Well, the problem with that is that even though that's the stated job, it's a real lose-lose situation because on one hand you're saying find the problems, and on the other hand, you're saying don't delay us. And so the people that are on the team many times are kind of in a quandary there, because if they find too many problems, they're seen as the roadblock to getting the product out the door. If they don't find enough problems, then management comes back to them and says, well, our customers are finding defects. You know, why aren't you guys catching this kind of stuff? And so this idea of being kind of like the last tackle on the field places an extreme amount of pressure on test teams, and actually a lot of teams don't stay in that position very long. They don't gel as a team. They don't stay together long enough really to work as a group for any number of reasons. It's one of those areas that companies like to build up and tear down. You know, it's like, I've heard one person say that it's kind of like the air conditioning. You never know that there's a problem until it breaks. And so when everything is working fine and the test team is doing their job the way they're supposed to, everything is, you know, hunky-dory, and people don't really pay much attention to it. And then they say, well, we don't really need it because we don't have any problems. Our customers are happy. Well, it's crazy. It's almost like the land of Dilbert. But the reaction is many times, well, let's take these test team people and put them in other areas and disperse them. And then the quality levels go down again, and then they have to build up the teams again.
Well, hopefully, though, there's a there's a person who survives the forming and the reforming and the reforming of these teams, because just as in any other situation, personnel come and go.
Right.
But if you can have a central individual, a leader, the team leader, who can survive each group and reassemble those for the next task, even if there isn't a perennial test team, you should be able to do okay, shouldn't you?
Well, that's a goal, and that's something that you would hope would be there. One of the problems, even with that, though, that would be the ideal, I agree. In our economy, there have been so many companies that have laid people off, and companies themselves, mergers and acquisitions and layoffs, and just the whole thing we've gone through in the past 10 to 12 years of this economy, it seems, the job situation itself is very unstable. There are people that do remain at companies for a long time and can stay in this position, and that person is very valuable. It's the dynamics of the workforce, though, that really is a challenge to a lot of people.
And that's why they call leaders leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a different kind of person than
Absolutely.
A manager, perhaps. A manager may be more administrative, more,
mm-hmm.
We won't get into what a manager might be. But a leader is someone who, when you say, let's go, everybody wants to get up and go.
That's right. That's right. They cast the vision, and they inspire people. They bring out the best. They coach. They mentor. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about in our test team leadership class is that managers and leaders are different. It's not necessarily that one is bad and one is good, but that just to understand that these are two different roles, and the problem is when you spend all your time managing, then you miss out on the coaching and the mentoring and the real, truly people-building side of this.
If you draw a picture, a manager would be what, and a leader would be different in what ways?
Well, the mental image I come up with on the manager is someone driving a car and trying to keep the car between two ditches. And the car might be swerving because everyone's trying to grab hold of the steering wheel.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of the analogy I see on a lot of teams. You know, so imagine this car going down the road, swerving, trying to stay out of the ditches. Well, the difference to me with the leader is the leader has now a firm grip on the steering wheel. Maybe someone else is actually steering the car, but the leader now is having every person in the car occupied with doing something that is not causing the thing to swerve between side to side on the road. They're going down the road in a straight way. They know where they're going. Someone has a map. Someone's reading it. Someone is, you know, maybe handing out snacks in the car or something. Maybe someone's at back in this back with duct tape over their mouth because they keep wanting to sing a dopey song, you know. So the leader is really more of the inspiration, but also making sure that things get done, but yet not in the control mode, okay? And, you know, you find leaders that are great managers and managers that are great leaders, and when you do find the same roles and the same people, that's a really neat thing.
That's a good find.
That's a good find.
Well, your job then, as a consultant, you go into companies and help teams know how to be the team?
Yeah, my favorite thing to do is to go train a group in a company and help their team bond and gel. And we actually, in our training courses, for example, we go through some little exercises, and we actually see the last project many times in a microcosm by going through simple exercises that have nothing to do with technology. It's all about people working together. It's amazing how many times people say, you know, we should have videoed this. In fact, now we do video some of these exercises because they said this is exactly what happened on our last project. And so we help the teams bond. We work with the leaders because one of the other things, Mickey, is that it's amazing how many people get thrown into the role of leading a test team and they know absolutely nothing or have no kind of background whatsoever in testing, but they've just proven themselves capable in other environments and other situations. So they get thrown to a test team, and then they hear the word regression testing, and they go, whoa, what's that? You know, or a certain kind of test tool, and they go, wow, you know, I didn't know that those things were available. And so it's really a two-pronged thing. We teach the teams how to gel, the leaders how to lead, and we also say, here's what you need to know about testing.
Well, you've raised some questions in my mind. I'm curious about what kinds of camp songs and rope course tricks you do to make the team gel, but maybe we'll get back to that in a minute. But what really comes to mind for me is this. As a member of a corporation who's proven himself as a leader, who might get thrown in as the team leader on a project, would you rather see a person who has the technical expertise that you then train to be a leader, or would you rather see a natural leader who you can help to work with the group?
Oh, it's much easier to take the leader and teach them the technical things that they need to know. And especially when it comes to testing, it's really, I think, kind of an unfortunate misconception that, you know, testing is rocket science, because I think that's kind of intimidating to managers. In fact, that's one of the things that I think about, one of the reasons I list why senior managers just don't really get a grip on testing, is that it's kind of unfortunately intimidating for some reason, and it really doesn't have to be. It's really not that hard. It's coming up with cause and effect. I do this, I should see this. And so I like to take even the more complex sides of testing and try to make them simple. And that's something that people have written sometimes on the evaluations, that, wow, you know, I never understood this, but, you know, Randy really made it simple in this class. And so that's my goal. And so I'd rather do that than trying to make something simple and make it sound complex to, you know, try to impress somebody. But the thing about it is, you can teach a leader a technical skill, but it's very hard to teach someone that's just purely a technician leadership skills. Those take almost a lifetime sometimes to build.
Absolutely. Understandable. It's funny, you don't want to let you don't want to disclose necessarily that it's not rocket science. You certainly don't want to devalue your own contribution.
my guru consultant mantle.
Well, you want to, right. I'm sure you want to be able to walk away and have those evaluations say things like, how in the world could we have done this without Rice Consulting? What are some of the things that people can expect? What is maybe some tangible ways that teams can grow and get additional value from working with Rice Consulting?
Well, we really try to put things on the lower shelf the best we can. We know
how do you mean put things on the lower shelf?
Well, we want to make things that are very obtainable to people, that they don't have to spend a lot of money to get. They don't have to spend a lot of money to buy certain tools or certain proprietary kind of processes where, you know, one of the things, I used to work for one of the major consulting firms, and we'd walk in with a box of three-inch, three-ring binders and, you know, charge them $1 million for the rights to use that stuff. And so at the end of the day, when we would leave, then they would be sitting there with a box of binders and all kinds of stuff on the shelves and never use it. And so really what I do is I teach people some basic things, like how to find a mentor.
To find a mentor?
Yeah, how to find someone in my company that can teach me the things I need to be taught, that can answer a question for me next week, next month, next year, about whatever it is I need to know. And it's a relationship that you build with someone in the company, not necessarily someone on the team. In fact, maybe even not someone in your company. One of the common questions I get about this topic is from someone on the team, what do I do when my team leader is the weakest link? How do I deal with that situation? Well, if the team leader has a mentor, you have someone that you can go to and say, you know, could you do a little coaching with so-and-so and kind of just deal with the situation that we're going through? Because we certainly feel uncomfortable, you know, broaching the subject with the person. And so what the mentor does is it gives some accountability, and it also gives a relationship that you can build into the life of someone else. And so mentoring doesn't cost you a thing except your time, and it's something that's very effective. Just basic coaching is a big thing too. So one of the things I go into with the team, I say everyone should have a mentor, and everyone should be a mentor. Even if you're a junior person on the team, you can be mentoring someone else. And when you teach someone something you already know, that just really reinforces it in your own mind.
You never understand anything like you could until it's time to teach it,
and then
you really get it inside and out.
That's right.
And that's part of what you bring to the picture, I take it.
Yep.
I'm guessing as long as you've been in the business, there's some feathers in your cap. There's some real success stories that you'd like to pull out and let people know about.
Well, you know, a lot of the success stories I've been a part of are things that I've seen my clients do. And that's really the exciting thing because, you know, when I stand up before a conference audience, I say, hey, look, the reason you should maybe pay attention to what I have to say is not because I've had all these great successes, but because I've been a part of some pretty spectacular failures. but one of my favorite stories of a success that a friend of mine actually had happened to him. You know, I'm the consultant, and I can leave. In fact, that's why I am a consultant, because I get out of the politics of a company and I don't have to mess with all the day-in, day-out stuff, you know. And so for those poor folks, my clients, who have to live with this stuff in the trenches, when you hear a story like the one I'm about to tell you, it's really cool. Well, a friend of mine got promoted into the position of being a test team leader. And so here he is, the team's already in place, and he walks in, and now he has to figure out some way to get these people to cooperate, to buy into his ideas, and to basically go along with the agenda. So he's a very talented, personable guy with a lot of experience, and so he basically did some research about the backgrounds of everyone on the team. And in the process, he learned that one of the guys on the team just really generally was known for having a bad attitude. Didn't socialize with people, you know, just did a lot of goofing off during the day, just really generally made it known to people he didn't want to be there. And so my friend goes in, and after the general orientation meeting where he introduced himself, kind of gave out some goals and objective for where he'd like to take the team, he called this fella aside and goes, hey, let's go get a cup of coffee. So he took the guy off, and they went to my friend's office, and he says, I understand that you just really don't like to be here, apparently. And he goes, that's right. He says, I don't like doing what I do. I don't mind telling you. I got assigned to this job. It's not what I ever envisioned doing when I went to work for this company. And you know, I can't wait to go someplace else. I'll just be real honest. So my friend says, well, what is it that you like to do? And he says, I love to build PCs. And what this guy was doing in his role currently, or in the situation, was he was writing test scripts. He was, you know, saying, step one, you do this, and you should see this. Step two, you do this, and you should see this. So he was in a purely documentation job.
Completely the opposite of the hands-on thing that he loves.
Exactly. It was very theoretical, very boring, never changes day after day. And I agree, it's very tedious and boring. And so my friend said, well, you know, we need someone who can configure the test lab. And he says, if you like working with PCs, let's just make that your job. And the guy says, really? You mean I can really do what I like to do? And goes, yeah. He says, now you got to understand, though, that with this job comes the responsibility that you are in charge of the test lab. And when we get something new that we have to test, and the lab needs to be ready on a certain date, it's your job to make sure that everything is configured and ready to go on that date. It's your baby. You're responsible for it from this day out. And my friend, as he tells the story, he says the guy was a changed man. He started coming into work early. He started staying late. Not that that's the measure of a good employee, but it shows that he had passion for what he was doing. And he said he started socializing with people after work. You know, they'd go, you know, get drinks after work or something. He would be there. They'd go, you know, have a softball game. He'd be there. And the social aspect changed. His passion changed, all because he was plugged into the area of his passion. And that's another thing, you know, we talk about people doing, is that we teach them to recognize, just like a coach recognizes someone on the team, where their strengths are and play to those strengths. Well, we do some things like that too.
Well, I can tell just by visiting with you that you're a people-oriented person. And when we come back from this break, I want to ask you some questions about your book, Surviving the Challenges of Software Testing, A People-Oriented Approach. Now, this is a book that's published by Dorset House Publishing. It's not one of those, buy the spine at Kinko's and hook the thing all together. and I can tell that, they don't publish books like this at Dorset House because that they think someone might buy them somewhere sometime. You've obviously had some success with it. So I want to talk with you more right after this break about your people orientation in software testing.
Okay, great.
If you would like more information about some of the things we're discussing today, visit riceconsulting.com. Be sure to sign up for Randy's free monthly e-newsletter, the Software Quality Advisor newsletter. You can sign up right from Randy's homepage at www.riceconsulting.com. At riceconsulting.com, you can also see a complete list of training courses, articles, links, and places where Randy will be speaking and training in the near future. You can also receive online training and mentoring right at your desk when you need it at riceconsulting.com. Check it out today. Welcome back. This is Software Quality Talk. I'm Mickey O'Neill, your host, and today's topic is Test Team Leadership. We're talking today with Randy Rice, author and principal consultant of Rice Consulting, about how to get the best results from your team. If you had just been listening just before the break, you would have heard a wonderful success story about bringing out the best in a team by bringing one individual out of an area that he was ill-suited for and allowing him to work in the area of his passion. It just made a changed person out of him. And as that works in team dynamics, every person on the team, I'm sure, was willing to contribute more then and happier to be part of the process. Randy, thanks for joining us again today, and it's good to be talking with you again, as always. Now, we've heard a little bit of the success stories. You got any bloopers you want to share with us? Because you're a consultant. You're paid for your the measure of your worth is not necessarily in the successes, but in the mistakes that you've made that you can help others avoid.
Oh yeah. Well, it's really kind of hard to pick out my top ones.
There's so many.
believe me, there are so many. And I know I gave the impression in the first segment there that I pack my bags and go away, but not every project has been quite that clean cut for me. In fact, I used to...
They follow you sometimes?
Yes, and I think sometimes they actually send out spies. But there was a point in my career where I was doing a lot of what I call extended project kind of work, where I would be on a project for anywhere from 12 to 18 months and, basically commute to wherever the project is. And I know there's a lot of people that work in that mode right now, and it's not fun. And people get burned out. Just off the top of my head here, I'm thinking of maybe one of the more notable problems and real challenges that we went through was on a project one time, and this is a classic case of getting the cart before the horse, so to speak. And they were trying to make rapid progress, and they were trying to take some shortcuts. And so one of the things that we saw was this has to do with the issue of where do you assign people and how do you get the workload in place. And so the decision was made that even though one of the core pieces of the system was not in place yet, that we would go ahead and bring on a staff of programmers anyway. And it wasn't really clear what these people were supposed to be doing or even when they were going to be doing it, but there were about 20 developers that were hired to start doing something.
Oh my.
Now, I bring out that scenario because it's really not that uncommon in the software industry to start doing something to show that you're making some kind of progress on something. And then when we find out the details, we'll kind of flesh it out later. Well, anyway, these 20 people were brought on, and we thought we had a template down of how the rest of the application was supposed to look. It was all going to be modeled after this one basic idea. Well, after about a month of coding, going down this trail based on this one template, the technical team that was truly working on the template and down in the core of the technology says, that's just not going to work. We've got to change our approach. It's just not workable. And we were going down trail A, And then all of a sudden, a month into it, we learned 20 people working for a month that, well, now we need to be going down trail B instead. And now all that effort was just down the drain. And
how common is that?
Well, it's actually fairly common. You know, it's just this idea of progress for progress's sake. And one of the things that companies fail to do many times is actually get a firm idea of what's to be built before it is built. And there's a lot of things that's done, like prototyping and things like that, where people will experiment with software development before they actually get the idea in place. And there's some value to that. But when it comes to the point that you've invested major resources, then it becomes a problem. And what the end result of what happened in this situation was, this put the company in such a cash flow bind, 20 people for a month and nothing to show for it, no deliverables to be paid for, that it actually wound up causing the company to go into bankruptcy.
Goodness.
And it was a it was an extreme example of really living out on the edge in software development. And I've lived through a lot of death marches, so to speak, where, you know, working 18-hour days, you know, for weeks on end trying to get something out the door. There's a lot of things that can be done about that, though, and that's the good news.
Well, I imagine you now carry in with you, when you show up with your briefcase, so to speak, as the consultant, the guy from out of town has to be carrying a briefcase. That makes you an expert automatically.
That's right. They give us those in consultant school.
That's great. I imagine when you pop that briefcase open, you've got some tool, whether it's in your mind or on paper, to ascertain right from the start, what is the true target? What are we really here for? So that you can avoid those types of things, because that bankruptcy doesn't just hurt that company, but those consultants who are preparing to submit their bill for their fees.
I know of one in particular, and I know of about probably 10 or 15 other than myself. Yeah, I was left carrying quite a big bag there myself. But the point you bring up is I do, you know, I've been doing this now for, this is going on 13 years, and in that time you accumulate a lot of good stuff. You accumulate a lot of good test plans, templates, all kind of good standards that people can use. And I certainly don't use a cookie-cutter approach because, you know, everyone's business and applications are a bit different. Business needs, business risk are different. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we can really adapt and use. And so one of the big values that my clients tell me they get from my service and that I hope I provide is that they don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, if I'm a test team leader, if I'm thrown into the role for the first time, my first question is, where do I find a good sample test plan? Where do I find a good sample test script? Well, I've got a lot of them, or if I don't have the ones you need, I know where you can find them. And so, you know, I kind of see myself as a facilitator in that regard, too. And when I do have to sit down with someone to help them map out a process or write a test plan, I don't just do it. You know, we sit side by side, or I work with a team and we brainstorm it out so that when Randy leaves at Friday afternoon to catch his little plane back to Oklahoma City, you know how to do it, you know, for the weeks to come and the months to come. And, you know, my goal is
you can even sleep through the whole weekend and still remember how to do it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You won't forget about it on Monday, even though you might want to. And so my goal is not to take the knowledge with me, but to leave the knowledge with the teams that I work with. So most of my engagements are actually fairly short.
And it's being about team leaders, I imagine that's the person you work the most with.
Yeah, we spend private time you know, with the leadership team, but we also we work with the team itself to gel. And it's, you know, a lot of this depends on the size of the team. Some of these are 5 to 10 people, some are 20 or more. So it, you know, it's a matter of resources there.
What kind of resources? What are some good resources that you bring to the table for team leaders specifically?
Well, but one of the things, of course, is the background of samples and processes and plans that I have. I also know I have a test tool database that I have that has over 300 tools and vendors. It has their 800 number, their web addresses, all of this. Even has the price of the tools when we know those things. And so I have a lot of people that retain me just to do a tool search. because they figure, hey, if I'm going to spend $50,000 or more on tools, you know, it's a good investment to bring in someone to help us do a good evaluation.
I guess.
So
that, you know, you sound a lot to me like something in my early experience. When I was a kid, I was a camper,
mm-hmm.
and I was a Boy Scout,
mm-hmm.
and I know you were too. In my troop, every time we went camping for 3 years solid,
mm-hmm.
it either rained or snowed. So I have so many terrible camping experiences behind me, but you know, you could drop me just about anywhere and I could build a fire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
mm-hmm.
care what the weather's like. Windy, rainy, snowy, whatever. I can find a way to do it. And I'm guessing you've been in enough snowstorms and rainstorms of software testing that you've got some tools in your bag, some things in your bag of tricks that you can pull out.
Well, that's right. And it's not only the tools themselves, but you mentioned, you brought up a very good point. The reason you could start a fire was because you knew the principle of starting the fire.
Right.
You know, you knew that no matter what kind of wood you had, as long as it was dry, you knew what it took to build a fire, and you knew about the oxygen and the small pieces. And that's really it. You know, we try to teach principles as
right.
opposed to exact processes. And your story also reminded me of something that this is going to be worth people just listening to this conversation. Here's a free deal that anyone can do, and it will add a lot of consistency. Now, they're going to hear this and they're going to say, oh, that's too easy. But, you know, just because it's simple does not mean it's easy. That's one of the great lessons in life I've learned. Just because it's simple doesn't mean it's easy. A checklist.
A checklist.
How many times on those camping trips did you get out into the middle of nowhere and you said, oh man, I don't have my toothbrush?
Well, once for each item.
That's right.
But only once.
Well, no, that's a good sign, because there were times that, you know, I said, I forgot that toothbrush again, or something like that. So the checklist is easy, it's simple to do, you know, it takes a while to develop, but it adds a lot of consistency. And it's cheap. You don't have to buy a big tool to do it. You know, even writing it down on paper. I have checklists for my own personal travels. I have checklists for when I do a test. There are just a lot of things. When I teach a class, you know, here are the things. Don't forget your projector. Don't forget your CD with the courseware on it, you know. They help us in a lot of things that we do.
Absolutely. And when it comes to tools, you know, a tool is not a tool if you don't know how to use it.
Right. And in our courses, I say a fool with a tool is still a fool.
Oh, my. We're getting off track here. We're supposed to be building leaders, not ridiculing ourselves.
Okay.
But the fact is that you have been there and you've made enough mistakes so that you're worth a lot of money as a software testing engineer. And I imagine that you have a list, too, not just of things to take with you and not to leave behind, like the toothbrush, but topics that you cover comprehensively in every time you go out. There, mm-hmm. there've got to be things that are consistent. Projects vary, people vary, personalities mm-hmm. vary, but there are certain base topics that you're going to hit every time.
Right. We actually have a modular approach to our courseware so that it's really plug and play. We have now over 80 different topic modules that we can put into a different order, but there are those that are core. One of those is the Surviving the Top 10 Challenges module, which talks about how do you deal with the people issues. We go through each of the top 10 and we do some exercises, and that's a really foundational thing. Another foundational thing is terminology. You know, a team has to be talking the same terms. If you're not talking the same terms, then you're assuming someone is doing something that you might think they're doing and they might think they're doing, but in reality you're talking about two different things. So terminology is a core one. Test planning is core, and also test evaluation, because, you know, if your team is designing tests that you have no way to evaluate, or you don't even know what the target is, then you're going to have a problem. Even if you could run that test, how do you know if it's correct or not?
Unbelievable. And I imagine you run into people who just go straight down that path and never think to bring that up.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's my biggest, I guess, if I had a gripe with doing just on-the-fly testing, you know, let's just try a few things and see if it works, is that the evaluation of it and the repeatability of it become very difficult. And plus, what you're doing is pretty much a one-time expense, but no time recoupment on that. So everything you do the same thing over and over again, but you never get to really build on what you've done before because every day is a new world.
Hmm. Very expensive way to operate.
Yeah.
You really piqued my interest when you talked about the surviving the challenges of software testing, the book, and going through the top 10 challenges. It reminds me of another host who has the 10 stupid things women do to ruin their relationships, and it sounds like this could be the 10 stupid things people do to ruin the process of software testing, which does, it sounds very technical on the surface of it, but I think it's probably going to be pretty similar to some of those things that we do in our everyday relationships.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'll just tell you real quickly how that book came about. It's kind of taken on an interesting life of its own, and it doesn't take much to be a bestseller in testing because the niche is so small. We've probably sold, 7,000 or 8,000 copies of it, and I was expecting maybe to sell 100 or so. So it's
copies kind of, or 100,000?
No, 100. Not
great.
So I've certainly exceeded my expectations, but I want everyone to know you don't get rich off of writing a testing book. But the way that came about, I wrote it with Bill Perry, and Bill's written about 30 other books on quality and testing, so I wanted to learn about his process. But we started asking testers back several years ago just to list the things that really gave them fits. What are your points of frustration? And, you know, we came up with about 30 different things, but after doing this time after time for years,
did you start to see a pattern?
Yes, definitely a pattern of about the same 10 to 12 things. And you know, the Letterman top 10 thing kind of was a play on deals on words there too. And so I thought, well, it'd be really neat to just have a book that was organized, each chapter being its own challenge. And now, you know, if we wrote the book today, I'd probably have a different order and maybe slide a couple of things in and out of positions there. But that is a very people-oriented book, and it really does get into those areas of how do I get my manager to understand testing? How do I get my customers and users involved in the testing process? And, you know, just some basic real-world project challenges that people face. And sure, there's some technical issues, and these are not the only challenges people are going to face, but they are some key ones.
Looking at the table of contents, tester one versus tester two.
I'm glad you picked up on that, because this is really something key for leaders. And every leader I consult with, I talk about this. Tester one is the person that enjoys finding the problems. They enjoy the challenge. They enjoy creating these really unique test scenarios that will just find that bug that people say, wow, I can't believe you found that. You are you're just the greatest tester in the world, and that's really where they like to be. Tester two is that person that has to fight the political battles. I need $10,000 to send Joe and Mary to a training class, or I need to buy a test tool, or oh, we have to get this product out by the end of the week, or you know, or we lose our jobs or something. I mean, or I have to counsel Joe over here because he didn't come back from lunch yesterday. You know, those are the things that cause the stress. If the testers that I've at least interviewed could just be tester one, they'd be happy.
Happy campers.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's that stress between tester one and tester two that we really address in the book.
And it's usually within the same body. I am
absolutely
tester one, but I have to also be tester two.
I call it getting in touch with your inner tester.
Well, what are some of the top people problems, for lack of a better term? You know, you go into a group, and I imagine you can sit back after this amount of time, and you're talking with the leader, and you're looking out at the group, and you say, oh, there's a stereotypical person B, you know, and here's a stereotypical version of this. What are these people? Because we're all people, we're going to fall into these roles. What kind of things do you see consistently?
Well, one of the things that I most commonly have to gently counsel people in, because I don't want to be guilty of the thing that I'm criticizing, but is that how do we bring an issue to the attention of someone? Like a developer. Let's say that I find a problem in a piece of software and I write up a defect report. I encourage people to put yourself in the role of the person receiving that defect report and ask, how would I feel if someone wrote this up on my stuff? And it's an eye-opening experience for a lot of people to go back and reread some of their old defect reports. You know, there's all kind of innuendo in some of those. Mm-hmm. And so just the way that we communicate a problem to someone else, and to understand that, hey, everything I report is something someone else has to fix. And how would you feel if you just had someone constantly coming in your door day after day? Oh, this doesn't work, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. You know, I know even around my house I hate that. You know, I say, how long am I going to have to keep fixing things around here? And I used to be a developer myself. So for about 12 years I was in that role. And so I really have a heart for
the developer.
Absolutely. I have an identity with them. And I understand what it's like.
Well, that's, and I imagine being the leader too. I guess you know you're a leader when you find friction happening all around you.
Mm-hmm.
If nobody's trying to resist what you're trying to urge, then maybe you're not really a leader yet.
Right.
And is there a way that you know as having been in a leader role myself, I know that when I first begin, there are the testing. It's like having your kids around.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to test the limits. But finally what happens is you reach breakthrough.
Mm-hmm.
And you find that all at once we are all moving in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
How can you help people accelerate that process and get to that place where they're going to be moving together as a team rather than fighting the little political battles of who really is the leader here?
Well, I think it's something that just doesn't happen. I think you have to take time out and communicate as a team, and you have to spend some time gelling as a team. And if you just let the flow of things occur and let it happen over, like some kind of evolution or some kind of thing that just happens over time, it's going to take a long time. If you make an effort to do it, to work together as a team, you learn about each other, you get to build some personal relationships with each other, and you know, this becomes more than just, you know, something we're all thrown together to do and we're all getting blamed together. That goes a long way.
It's so you're recommending a proactive approach versus reactive.
Absolutely, and a very human awareness-oriented kind of thing, because, you know, what all this boils down to is, you know, these are people making technology work. The tools just and the computers just don't rise up and do this thing.
Not yet.
And I hope they don't. The attack of the clones, you know, kind of thing.
But the ability to be proactive relies upon foreknowledge.
Absolutely.
And I'm guessing that that's what people are going to get out of the book, Surviving the Challenges of Software Testing. Where can I get that book, other than stealing the one off of your desk?
Yeah, you can get it at the Friends of the Library book sale. I think it's coming up this weekend here in Oklahoma City. No, you can get it from Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, any of the major booksellers. You know, sometimes I go out on the road and I do an ego search. I'll go to Borders or Barnes & Noble and see if it's on the shelf. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not, but BooksAMillion.com is probably the best price that people will find. They can also get it directly from Dorset House, or they can get it by attending one of my classes. I give one to every attendee and most of the classes that I teach.
Fantastic. One last question, if I could wrap up. If you're coming on site and your plane has landed and I've come to pick you up at the airport, and you realize that I'm going into the challenging role of being a team leader in who knows what situation, if we had just 20 minutes in the ride from the airport to the site, and you knew we were both going to be jumping into the fire, and you could communicate one key point to me about being an effective team leader, what would that be?
Man, that is a tough question. I would say, you know, that I believe it all boils down to you've got to get the trust of the team. The team has got to trust in you as a leader on several levels. They've got to believe that you know what you're talking about. They've got to believe that you care about them as people. They've got to believe that you're looking out for their best interest, and that you're going to lead them to a place that is going to be a good place to be. I started thinking about this the other day, actually. Why do mutinies happen? You know, someone thinks that they know more than the leader. Someone thinks that the leader is taking them to a place that is either going to be painful or non-productive.
And all of those can be true. There will always
Absolutely.
Be people on the team who know more about something than the leader. And when you talk about the leader, knowing what they're talking about, one of the things I find most gratifying and most endearing in a leader is that when mistakes happen, they'll stand up and say, you know what, group, I made a mistake here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's got to be an acceptance of responsibility by the leader. And, you know, one of the things that John Maxwell talks about, and by the way, he's one of my favorite authors on leadership, his that John Maxwell talks about in his book, the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership, is the law of the lid. And basically what that law says is that my team is not going to rise above my own level of leadership. So if I'm a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10 as a leader, everyone below me is going to be a 5 or below. Now, that deal about the mutiny we were just talking about happens when you are a 5 and someone on your team might be a 6 or 7 or an 8. Now, they're either going to try to come up above you, or they're going to go someplace else, or there's going to always be that pressure below you. I bring this up because what that means is, as the leader, I can't just sit back and say, hey, I'm a leader, because that's after my name. You know, I'm Randy Rice, test team leader. I've got to be always working to develop my skills. And I've got, if I'm a 5, I'm looking at how do I get to be an 8 as soon as I can. How do I go up that ladder? Now, that's not to say you're going to be great in every area, because there are going to be certain things that, you know, could be delegation, could be communication, but I can at least know where my weaknesses are, and maybe have someone on my team that is the go-to person to fill in those gaps. And that's another way to kind of help the whole mutiny thing, and this idea that people want to rise up above.
Right. So, Mr. Leader, get the trust of your team. Do so by being willing to lead them only in places you yourself would go. Always struggle against your own apathy, against your own inertia. Mm-hmm. Keep growing and keep being the leader.
That's all there is to it.
Quite simple, isn't it?
There you go. But not easy.
Randy, good discussion. Really appreciate it. I look forward to our next time together.
So do I, Mickey. Thanks a lot.
If you would like more information about some of the things we're discussing today, visit riceconsulting.com. Be sure to sign up for Randy's free monthly e-newsletter, the Software Quality Advisor newsletter. You can sign up right from Randy's homepage at www.riceconsulting.com. At riceconsulting.com, you can also see a complete list of training courses, articles, links, and places where Randy will be speaking and training in the near future. You can also receive online training and mentoring right at your desk when you need it at riceconsulting.com. Check it out today.